Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and Don Fifield of the Guardian. A football club, a city, a global community are in mourning. A stadium is a shrine, a field of flowers. Koen Vichai, to give him his formal title, made dreams come true. His investment in Leicester was emotional, not just financial. He understood the bonds between fans and team, club and community. It takes tragedy to reaffirm reality. Football is frivolous, but a powerful point of reference. One shirt, left by a Wolves fan, said it all. Divided by colours, united by grief. Now, Johnny, you were at the King Power on Saturday night. You've been back since. Mm-hmm. You live in the city. You wrote a definitive book on the title win. Give us an idea of what your city and our game have lost.
Yeah, this cuts very deep, first of all, in the city of Leicester, Mike. I was at the stadium this morning. In fact, I was there yesterday to see the tributes and the flowers, which have grown from one or two bouquets to just a huge sort of sea of flowers and bouquets outside turnstiles 52 and 53. People crying, people stunned, very kind of somber mood, very poignant, because the last time there was anything like this on a non-match day, that kind of gathering, you know, you've got Roerdyk's Road full of cars, you've got people just coming to an empty stadium, was when they won the title a couple of years ago. There's a real poignant counterpoint to that. And I think that's a supporter's grief, but it goes beyond that. Leicester's a small city. It's a one-club city. He was a very generous man, not just within the football club, but to the community. He gave to the local university, to the local hospital. He supported other local causes. There are a lot of small-scale stories that haven't been publicised of sort of personal kindness. So he's someone that made an impact on the whole community. And you know, just going around daily life, I was at a children's party yesterday. The mums are all talking about this. You know, in the supermarket, it's what people were talking about at the checkouts. It's really affecting everyone. Everyone knows someone that was at the game. You know, as I say, it's a small place. And Leicester's not actually, you know, it's a low-key kind of city. It's a restrained sort of city. And this sort of outpouring of grief is quite unusual in the community. And I think it'll be quite some time before people get over this.
Mm. You went to report on a football match on Saturday night. And that football match was immediately put into context. Can you give us an insight into what happens when a disaster literally happens 100 yards away?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like anything I've thankfully had to report on before, but we were all at the end of Claude Puel's press conference as a sort of live reporter. You're at that point doing your rewrite of your match reports and maybe filing a quotes piece, which is what we were all starting to do. And it was actually the photographers at the game had kind of left en masse and all gone up to the press car park, which is on sort of elevated ground looking back down onto the King Power Stadium. And texts and calls started coming through from the photographers, who were pretty much all at that point packing stuff up in their cars, and they'd seen the helicopter gone down. And the minute you heard the message, the helicopter's down, you knew what it was. We all came running out of the stadium, went sort of round the main stand to the south stand, and you could see in the far off corner just a kind of fireball which is where the helicopter was, emergency services rushing to it and trying to clear the area of people. And it just becomes very surreal. At that point, there's a lot of hearsay on social media. People are speculating straight away. But as a reporter, you really need to be absolutely sure, particularly in something like this, of the facts. We all went back to the stadium, to the press room. And I have to say that the way Leicester City dealt with the situation was quite incredible, given what he meant to every member of staff there as well. You know, people were personally grieving, but as us press trying to help us as much as possible, they reopened the press room, they brought in sandwiches, teas and coffees, and tried to just update us and give us as much as we could. And we were there till, well, it was 1 a.m, it was really 2 a.m. because the clocks went back, and there was nobody sort of, you know, asking you to leave, kick you out. It was, you know, in an hour of real difficulty and grief, they thought of others and they were really generous as a football club. And I have to say, I think that comes from the culture that Convice fostered.
Mm. We go around the Premier League. You know, Leicester always had a reputation of being a really welcoming club. Mm. I think what struck me also was the sort of visceral reaction of some of the players. You know, you had Kasper Schmeichel in tears running out into the car park. You know, we live in an age where, you know, players are portrayed as quite distant figures, but you didn't get that at Leicester.
No, it's one of the ways in which they as a club are different, and one of the ways I think his chairmanship, his ownership was different. He described himself as the father of the club, and he tried to embody that and had a kind of paternal relationship with players. So someone like Kasper, who the longest serving member of the first team squad, has had a relationship with him going back 7 or 8 years. Vichai, for example, when there was a time when Kasper was on holiday, he was asked to come back and film an advert for the club. And Vichai laid on his helicopter to get him there and get him back to his family as quickly as possible. When, you know, everyone knows the story of them buying the cars when they won the title, but that's just a small kind of representation of the relationship they had. They looked after the players, they took them to parties, they rewarded them with meals. It might sound trite, but I think we're in an age for top footballers, that, or football generally, where, I know, people are searching for meaning, for fun a little bit. There's so much money in the game, it's such a distant machine at sometimes. It feels like football. And you can see, you know, in managers like Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp, and top managers try and foster a kind of family feeling among their squad, because footballers are searching for a bit of meaning, I think. It's, you know, people want to have fun and feel like they're playing for something more than just the business. And that happened quite organically at Leicester because of the way Vichai ran the club. They felt they were playing for family. They felt they were playing for each other. We saw that in the title season. And that did come from this way the club culture was set from Vichai.
Mm. You know, we talk about supporter engagement and involvement of the community, Dom. There's a question here from one of the listeners, Ian Taylor. Surely he's got to be remembered as the best owner to ever own a football club. Everything you want and more, from free beers to free donuts on his birthday.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think he probably will be remembered as one of the best there's ever been. The little touches, like the beers and donuts, were nice touches. But it did, again, it harnessed that feeling of everybody belonging together and in a sort of family atmosphere. I was more moved really by the money he's ploughed into the hospitals. I think he gave £2 million towards a £10 million hospital for children in Leicester. I think there was money put through to the Leicester City Foundation. He just pledged £1 million at an end-of-season award ceremony. Yeah. I mean, it's just little things like that make a massive, massive difference to the community. And owning a football club, he got it. He actually understood that when he was buying Leicester City, he wasn't just buying a money-making entity on the other side of the world. He wanted to feel as if he was part of that community, and the football club is core to the community. And he engaged with that, and everything he and Leicester City achieved, well, it is a fairy tale, even for supporters of other clubs as well, to look at him now. He allowed supporters of clubs of Leicester City size, which, let's face it, that's pretty much every club outside the top six in the Premier League, to dream that they can achieve something as remarkable as Leicester City did in 2016.
Mm. I mean, one thing I saw down at the memorial was shirts from other football clubs. There was a Sheffield United shirt, Barnsley shirt, Aston Villa shirt, Celtic shirt, Arsenal, Manchester United, lots of rugby shirts. Now, Leicester's a city, they always say, divided by codes rather than by clubs. You know, there's always been a rivalry between the rugby and the football team. A lot of rugby shirts down there yesterday. And I think you've got to remember, he took over at a time when foreign ownership had a bad name. You know, I think the Venkies family were making a mess of Blackburn. He took over from Milan Mandrić, who wasn't particularly popular with supporters. And there was a wonderment, you know, who is this guy? Is this going to be another foreign owner who doesn't get it? And as Dom said, he really actually did get it. And I think what the respect from fans of other clubs represents is people just looking at Leicester and thinking, yeah, we wouldn't mind a bit of that. He's a guy that seemed to have fun as well while he was being owner. I've heard other chairmen speak admiringly about, yeah, you know, that's what we have to aspire to as well.
You know, we talk about legacy in times like this, don't we, Dom? Is part of the legacy going to be that it just doesn't have to be this way? It doesn't have to have a culture in which owners, quite frankly, are billionaire parasites.
Yeah, and you'd like to think that that's what we learn from Leicester City under his stewardship. There are tangible legacies. I mean, they got planning permission last week on a £100 million new training complex, which will presumably go ahead. And you know, Leicester City as a club are virtually unrecognisable from the club that he bought, which was, you know, as you say, virtually a shell. Yeah. The expansion of the stadium. But you're right, it's a philosophy. I mean, you'd like to think that owners coming into the Premier League, and there will always be new billionaire owners appearing on the scene because of the amount of money floating around the English game, will look at what he achieved and the way he did it and the affection in which he's held and think this is actually the way to own and run a football club in this country.
Mm. I suppose, sadly, you know, things will revert to type to a degree. But, you know, there was a sense of not just the city coming together, but football coming together at Leicester. You know, the images of little children being, you know, holding their dad's hand, going down there and all that. We live in an age, a very harsh age of tribalism, which is usually expressed quite harshly and abusively through social media. Again, is that another wake-up call that it doesn't have to be like that?
I think so. I think there's a nasty edge to, but certainly the fandom that you see on social media. There's a tribal edge, as you say, that it's always been there, but I think the modern world nurtures that kind of thing. And you know, it's 2 years ago we were taking pleasure in Leicester City's title win, and I felt since then maybe we were starting to revert to type again. Football is becoming, and you know, we're talking romantically about what they've done, but there's a harsh reality, which is that the big clubs are getting bigger. Mm-hmm. It's getting harder and harder for teams to ever do what Leicester did again. But it's only 2 years ago, and this gives us another chance to think again about what happened. I mean, the squad that won the title cost £21 million. You know, it was built through the bonds that I've spoken about. It was built through good recruitment. It was built through a culture. And there is another way. There is another way for clubs to be run. As we sort of said, you know, sack Claudio Ranieri and Craig Shakespeare. This, you know, like any other owner, he had to make hard decisions. So we can't say that he was a soppy romantic. He was a very clever businessman. A decisive figure. But that's part of football as well. I just think we have got a chance to look at this Leicester story again and just think, you know, football should be about romance.
Well, we should cherish that. But again, the reality of it, Dom, sort of moving onto football issues to a degree, on a broader level, it seems even this season that the top five or top six, depending on however you want to look at it, are getting stronger. The rich are getting richer. Where are we going with that?
One way at the moment. I mean, it just feels as if You're right. It's that is in some ways a reaction to what Leicester City did. Yeah. It was the wake up call for the elite clubs because they underachieved badly and allowed, you know, the pretenders to take the crown. But they have reacted in a staggering way. I mean, City leading the way, obviously with Pep, but you could argue the same with Chelsea. The level of investment that they've lavished. And they've taken Leicester City's prize assets.
Look
N'Golo Kanté.
Yeah, look at Mahrez on the
City.
Bench.
Yeah. And that is a worry that you get, you know, players who are capable of winning a title at Leicester suddenly sitting on the bench and only contributing cameos here and there.
Because football moves so fast, doesn't it? Yeah. If you look at that title-winning team, you've only got two players left in the team, haven't you?
Yeah, you have, yeah. I mean, it really...
And Schmeichel and Vardy.
And Vardy was a substitute at the weekend. You know, he may have quite a long sort of, you know, downslope, but maybe he's on it already. I mean, Leicester had to fight Manchester United to keep hold of Harry Maguire in the summer. You know, as Dom said, their assets are being sort of targeted by bigger clubs as well.
That said, they managed to keep him.
They managed to keep him, yeah.
And there is a level of resistance that the other clubs can muster now because of the finances involved in the game, and even finishing mid-table or lower mid-table, you're still able to spend big on wages and retain these players for a certain length of time. I've been surprised this season at how few shocks there have been with the top elite clubs. Yeah. Mm. But, you know, I think it's time for the lower rank, the middling clubs, that they can raise their games. They maybe just need... It just needs an occasion, maybe somebody slightly playing off the top form. I mean, we saw it yesterday. I was at Selhurst yesterday. Palace haven't scored there this season, but they made Arsenal look very average, apart from a 6-minute spell in the second half. So it, maybe little games like that, little reminders that, you know, the also-rans can compete with them, and we'll see more sort of shocks. But it has been a worrying trend to date this season.
I have to say. Because the numbers do stack up, don't they, Johnny? If you look at Liverpool, you know, they've had a terrific start. But if you look at Cardiff on Saturday, they were able to rotate.
Yeah.
And you then looked at the strength in depth in the squad, which is what the biggest clubs can buy. You've got someone like Shaqiri coming in for, was it 13 million?
Yeah.
And being, you know, an invigorating presence.
Yeah, you've got Liverpool taking them apart. You've got Chelsea going to Burnley without Eden Hazard and hammering them. You know, Burnley, difficult place to go, but not for them. If you look at Liverpool, City and Chelsea, I think you're seeing defensive numbers that we'd associate with, I don't know, Mourinho's Chelsea in 2005, but you're seeing attacking numbers that you almost think about the 1920s or something, scoring 100 goals that season. It's but that tells you know we're getting goal differences of plus 70 now when teams win the title. I know City, you know, maybe City are beyond the level we're talking about anyway, but there is a polarisation because the smaller clubs are actually, you know, as Dom said, they're paying higher wages. They're actually spending more money on players than ever before, and yet the gap's still growing.
And that's growing, as you said. If you take Liverpool as an example, you know, that front three has scored 18 goals, I think, so far. You've got Shaqiri to back it up. Are Liverpool now working themselves into a position where they are viable potential champions?
Well, yeah, they are viable potential champions, and they'd be certainties if Manchester City and Pep Guardiola weren't in the division. I still think that they'll fall short of City's levels, but that said, they've made massive strides. We know that's through the investment, that's through the recruitment and the management of Jurgen Klopp. It started with Virgil van Dijk, Alisson coming in made a massive difference in the summer. But you're right, the squad depth, having a Shaqiri who can just throw in and take some of the pressure off Sadio Mane or Roberto Firmino. I mean, you say 18 goals in that front three, but we've been saying all season they haven't really been firing. I mean, and that in itself is terrifying, isn't it, for the rest of the division? But I still think, although it's tight at the moment and Liverpool indeed ended the weekend top of the division, I still think the City are a class apart. I still think they're just slightly higher level than all of the rest, Liverpool included. You just hope that Liverpool stay with them for as long as possible to make it as competitive as possible. Chelsea should probably be thrown in there as well because they've surprised everybody with the way they've adapted so far under Maurizio Sarri.
Yeah, management's about, you know, one, the management of expectation, but two, maximisation of resources. Now, if you look at Jurgen Klopp specifically, you know, you've been studying that club quite hard recently, haven't you? What struck me about it was almost like the democracy of the dressing room. You know, we had Van Dijk as captain at the weekend, elected by his peers. Again, that's empathetic, quite emotionally intelligent management, isn't it?
It is. That's a huge part of how Klopp manages. And a story that is regularly told when you look at signings is players choosing to go into that environment and to play in that dressing room. You know, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's fantastic player. He made exactly that choice. He's injured. Liverpool are doing all this with one of their best players from last season.
It's easy to forget, isn't it?
It is. And I think what Klopp does is he invests in people. So if you think about Van Dijk, he was willing to wait for him. He identified him, willing to wait for him. You know, Van Dijk thought it was the move had been denied for him, but Liverpool kept the place open. Joe Gomez, maybe the best player they've had this season. He's playing at incredible levels, really exciting the way he's developing. You know, Gomez spent a lot of last season injured, but the place was kept open for him. He's a young person that Klopp really believes in. Gini Wijnaldum's had an incredible season. Wijnaldum, Klopp was stuck with, despite doubts from supporters and people wondering, you know, even when he was signed, 25 million for this bloke from Newcastle. But it is management where he really does invest in people and believes in them. And, you know, that gets reciprocated through the commitment we see in their performances.
Mm. Liverpool at Arsenal on Saturday. Now, as you said, you know, Dom, you saw Arsenal at the weekend. Is that the daunting task for Liverpool than it might appear? Or do you think they've got more than enough to deal with it?
It'll be a test of Liverpool's defence, which has been outstanding to date this season. But Arsenal's strength is all in their forward line. Mm. Their defence is a deception. and it's bizarre to say that after 11 wins on the bounce. But, I mean, I think even Arsenal supporters can see that. They're not... And Emery can certainly see that because he talks about this being a process and let's not get too carried away. You know, we're building towards something, but we're nowhere near there yet. I saw them at Fulham, and we forget that although they ran riot after the interval, as they tend to do, they was 1-1 at half-time and they'd been exposed a few times. Leicester City could easily have been 2 or 3 up at the Emirates at half-time. They should have had a penalty. They scored one. They conceded right on the interval. And for all the brilliance of Mesut Ozil's second-half performance, we shouldn't forget that Arsenal could have been out of that game. Palace actually, in periods, bullied them. I mean, Palace. Mm-hmm. Palace don't score goals. They don't score goals, any goals at home. And there were times when Arsenal were properly stretched. Mustafi just doesn't look like a Premier League player, let alone a player who should be representing Germany. And I feel a bit sorry for Rob Holding because I think he's trying his best in there, but he's not got the support around him. Granit Xhaka is no left back, and we know that he's filling in. But it's just to lose Bellerin as well, potentially to a muscle injury. He didn't come out for the second half. And Lichtsteiner is not the same player that he was a few years back, so it's an issue.
He was a one-season reserve, wasn't he, basically?
They brought him on. It was almost as if they brought him on for one reason alone, and that was to kick Wilfred Zaha up in the air. And he did it 3 times, eventually got booked on the 3rd time, and that calmed it all down a bit. But he's not... You know, the thought of Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, Firmino, backed up with that vibrant midfield tearing at that Arsenal back line will be worrying Unai Emery this week.
Mm. So it looks like Leno, who's probably got the nod as number one now over Peter Cech, he's going to have a busy time, isn't he?
He might do, yeah. I mean, he's a very good shot stopper, Leno. He's got sort of mistakes in him, as they say, about goalkeepers. But he's a pretty good shot stopper, so if he's active, he might do all right. But, yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed by Emery. I underestimated him, I think. And I think the defensive problems that we're talking about actually makes it all the more impressive what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, if you can contrast him with Mourinho, who on a weekly basis is complaining about his defence and letting us know that he didn't get to sign who he wants. Well, Emery's just got on with it. He's, you know, I mean, that penalty that Mustafi gave away was just laughable, absolutely laughable from an international defender. I was among a couple of journalists who had a bit of time with Raul Sanlehi and Venkatesham last week, and they were talking about the plans for the club, and they accept that Arsenal don't have the money that the other sort of five or four of the big six have got. And they said, you know, we have
their owner does, by the way. Their owner,
he does, yeah, yeah. Maybe it's not being sort of funneled through in the football side. And they talked about how, in order to succeed, they have to squeeze every drop from every sector. Well, there is a job to be done, I think, in recruitment, which was very good this summer, but they didn't sign, you know, class defenders. They did well in other areas of the pitch. I think the next step is to squeeze every drop from that recruitment department and sign some better defenders.
I would say that they're going to be great fun to watch all season, because the forward line is
brilliant,
mouth-watering.
Absolutely. Aubameyang Mayang's great.
It's wonderful, and a great predatory striker. I think Lacazette is hugely underrated. He had a poor first season, but Unai Emery has found a way of integrating both him and Aubameyang into his team. Ozil, when he plays like he played last week against Leicester, is sublime. Did nothing this weekend, but you never know. He might be saving himself for Liverpool. Mm. Might be.
But I'm assuming you got closer to the riddle of why they won't offer, why they withdrew the contract offer to Aaron Ramsey.
Yeah.
And they're now saying, aren't they, look, we're not going to let people run down contracts anymore, which sounds a statement of the obvious to me. Yeah. But
well, absolutely. And to be fair, at the time, you know, they said, we're not reinventing the wheel here. That's just good sense not to allow this kind of situation to happen. But it happens so often at Arsenal in the last decade, I guess, of Wenger's stewardship. And I think Ramsey, I feel slightly sorry for him, because I think he's almost being used as an example. I think they're making a stand on that particular situation and saying, no, we're not going to allow a player to do this or allow this to happen and then the player to bully us. And it would appear that Ramsey would actually quite like to stay, but wants to be paid his market worth. And you can understand that from the player's point of view. He might just be caught in the middle of them making a stand to emphasise their policy change and you know the situation that he's in.
Because if you look at the contrast to that, the antithesis of it is Paul Pogba at Manchester United, who essentially seems to me to be behaving, you know, as a one-man team, in his own mind at least. So I suppose the question is he sublime or ridiculous, or both?
He's a World Cup winner.
Yeah.
You got to always have that context, innit? It's about management getting the best out of the talent available, and there is clearly a lot of talent there with Paul Pogba. Jose Mourinho's got to find a way of making him more consistent, and that's about management. It's about man management.
I think he's fundamental to them, whether they like it or not. When I watch United, one of the things that strikes me is there's a basic lack of football quality in a lot of areas of that team, and then you've got Pogba, who's brimming with football quality, but maybe not channeling it.
And he brings the best out of Martial to a degree, doesn't he?
Some of the passes he played to Martial yesterday were extraordinary. And the pair of them have got a very good connection off the pitch, on the pitch as well. So whether Jose likes it or not, Pogba's the best footballer he's got. Martial's probably the other best footballer he's got. And he's got to use the pair of them. Mm. And that gives Pogba power politically, I guess.
Mm. You observed Mourinho close up. At Chelsea. Was there ever a time at Chelsea where he almost acknowledged mediocrity in the way he seems to be doing now at United?
Look, when it unravelled the second time at Chelsea, his mood, you know, veered from one extreme to the other every week, and you know he would be praising mediocre performances in a desperate attempt to get some kind of, you know, positive consistency in the team's displays. Next week he would hammer those same players. But he's in a situation now at United where, he's in chief whinge mode in terms of the money that he wants to spend, more money to lavish upon the whole project. But I don't think he's actually, if he's having as much say as it's implied in who he's bought, I don't think he's really justified having so much say in the future as to what happens next in terms of the transfer market. They are such a stodgy team to watch. And yet, you know, the performance against Everton arguably was probably their best home display of the season. But even so, they were there were moments after Sigurdsson's penalty where you're wondering whether that even this is going to go against them. It's quite heartening to see Martial's revival, but that doesn't actually reflect particularly well on Jose Mourinho, I don't think.
No. In a way that Mata's re-emergence doesn't as well, does it?
But that all has implications, I guess, on Romelu Lukaku as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's another big problem they've got now is Lukaku was, I guess, through the really difficult times early in the season, he was Jose's kind of spokesman, his reference point, because he invested so heavily in him and did pretty well at the start last season. And he's, you know, I wouldn't say the dressing room's full of Jose Mourinho allies, but he would be one of them. But I'm not sure they can put him in the team at the moment because he's playing so badly.
Mm. Do you think all this will eventually end up costing them David De Gea?
It could do, and there's a subplot there because, you know, same agent as Jose, and it all gets very political. It is a strange football club at the moment, a club that lacks continuity, and that the best player by a mile, you know, Pogba might be the best footballer, but the best player is David De Gea. The fact that the one totally prized asset is the one that they're most in danger of leaving, I think, says everything about United. And I think the only way to solve this long term is to have someone running the football department that gets a total grip on this, which will mean a director of football, I guess. And that's not something Jose Mourinho is going to want. So more politics ahead.
More politics and a little bit of sort of pantomime. Pep Guardiola talking about a top five now rather than a top six. Now, no prizes for guessing who he's excluded from the six.
I think I'll get Spurs.
Bit of banter, I suppose they call that, don't they?
Yeah, they will do. I mean, that's quite mischievous, isn't it? But he's in a position where he can say whatever he wants. His team's so good. They won't go down particularly well on the red half of Manchester. But
is there some basis to it, though, do you think?
Well, they're playing a game of catch-up, United, aren't they? And you wouldn't look at them and think they're a team that's A, going to challenge for the title. Certainly not going to challenge for the title this season. But because the teams above them have actually done pretty well. I mean, Spurs, we talked earlier about there not being very many surprises. Spurs did lose at Watford, who are one of the resurgent teams in that sort of middle group. But Spurs have still had their best start to a Premier League season. Mm. Arsenal, OK, they haven't. Whenever they come up against someone good, like the City and Chelsea in the first few weeks, they lost those games, but they won a long sequence subsequently. United are playing catch-up to these guys. Chelsea, under Sarri, have been a bit of a revelation again, as they tend to do every other year under different management, usually. But that's what United are trying to... They're not really trying to catch City. They're trying to catch the fourth best team in that group, and they're all playing quite well.
And it's interesting, they're at Bournemouth at the weekend. When you look at that fixture, you immediately think about Eddie Howe, the job he's doing there. Does that deserve greater recognition?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, part of the madness of the game at the moment is that if he was doing that in Germany or Spain, then every top club in Britain, in England, would want to have him as manager. But, of course, there's this glass ceiling in the Premier League where, you know, Eddie Howe at Bournemouth's almost taken for granted. I mean, that he's built the club over the long term. He's instilled his values in the football club. That's expressed in the way they play, the commitment they give him, the energy they'll hit United with will be a problem for United. And he is still improving as a manager. I think this is the best start of the season he's had. I think Bournemouth have kicked on. The recruitment hasn't always been their strongest suit. I think it's been better. There's younger players like
David Brooks, for instance.
Brooks, Fraser, that are starting to really come into their own. It's a team... You know, it's so impressive that after 6 years there, he's still taking the club in an upward direction, still squeezing different bits here and there. And
it was an interesting stat on Saturday when they played Fulham, who basically, you know, throwing £100 million at the wall and see what sticks. Yet that Bournemouth team, seven of that team had been in the starting lineup when they'd last played Fulham, which was 2 or 3 years beforehand. So, as to your point, it's a gradual process.
But the evolution of Bournemouth's football team took huge steps forward this summer when the recruitment worked. Mm. Jefferson Lerma has made a massive difference. Yeah. That partnership with Lewis Cook in central midfield is abrasive, it's awkward, it's horrible to contend with. David Brooks has come in and hit the ground running, and not many of Eddie Howe's bigger signings in the past had done that, which is why he's had to rely upon, you know, the bulk of a team that really excelled in League One and through the Championship. They are a team that feels progressive now, and they will give United a horribly awkward afternoon, because we talk about how teams press. They are all over them. Yeah. I mean, they're hands on. They're horrible. They're not. They score some beautiful goals and beautiful teamwork goals, but they've got a real nasty side to them as well, which is admirable for a team of that, a club of that size.
Mm. They're probably now the biggest club on the South Coast, aren't they? Southampton, you know, they've got City.
Yeah.
Mark Hughes going back to the Etihad. The signs aren't great there, are they? He was berating the home fans. There is this element that they, almost that they were lucky to get away with it last season, and they're just sliding straight back into relegation troubles again.
Yeah, there's a bit of an echo at Southampton for me of Stoke a few years ago, where the club had come through a very successful period and then started to try and change, but then through changing lose its set of values, its identity, supporters who aren't quite sure what they're looking for. I'm not sure what Southampton supporters, and I don't blame them for it, but feel their club should be achieving. You know, Claude Puel, they just didn't take to him at all, but he finished eighth or something like that. Mark Hughes, they struggled to establish a bond with the fans straight away. And there's a sort of kind of stale air about it all, stale on the pitch as well. I think, you know, nothing particularly exciting emerging at Southampton. The better players are still the ones that, you know, they've had for a while and just are declining. They may stay in the league because other teams are so bad, but it looks like a pretty miserable season. And of course, they're not scoring any goals at the moment.
Mm. Talking of teams that are pretty bad at the moment, what about Newcastle? Can you see any logical way that Rafa Benitez will be there this time next year?
No, not really. I think he'll go when his contract expires. I think that he can only work with that regime for as long as you can. And as much as he's feted and adored by the supporters, it must be horribly grating for him on a daily basis to be working in an environment that he can see the potential, he can see what he wants to do, but can't actually do it. Mm. They're in for a slog of a season as well, but I still think I still think Benitez will make the difference to them. And he'll get them playing in a similar vein to last year. I think 10th was obviously flattering last season, but it was a great achievement as well. But I think they'll actually hopefully use that result at Southampton, which was a poor performance, but it was a point, a clean sheet, and maybe use that as a springboard to better things. Again, like all the teams down the bottom, apart from Fulham, goal scoring is the issue.
Yeah. I'm talking to managers who aren't happy. Mauricio Pochettino has come out and basically said this is the unhappiest he's been at Spurs. That's a big warning sign, isn't it?
It's a huge warning sign. I mean, Real Madrid might be making an appointment today, so that might ease a few worries for Spurs in terms of Pochettino. But you can't.
Conte, of course.
Yeah, Conte. Yeah, you can't blame him. I mean, if you start with the stadium, you know, I think it's terrible for supporters that they've kind of been led to believe they'd be in the new White Hart Lane and then they're at Wembley. But it must be very unsettling for the manager and players as well. And it kind of denies you your home advantage. Then there's the having to sit and watch the investment taking place at other clubs, and that's not possible at Spurs. Has never really been possible, but less possible now because of the stadium. And there's a sense that they're relying on Pochettino's, you know, work ethic and skills to make up for the other differences between them and the top five or six. And if you're the guy being asked to go to the well all the time, I think, of course, you're going to be unhappy. He's got to keep motivating the players who have overachieved for him. He does seem to be in a bit of an existential crisis point at this moment, and you can't blame him. He's done so much for Spurs, and I guess when you do that, you want the people behind you to keep pushing you forward, but he's not getting that at the moment.
Mm. Do you think Daniel Levy's been very lucky to avoid pretty widespread criticism for the way you know, the fiasco, let's put it like that, of the new stadium not being ready on time. They're playing at Wembley on a pitch which looks appalling. Yeah. And that's because of overuse. Well, Spurs have been there overusing it.
Yeah, although there was a it's a fairly unique situation with the NFL game, which was bizarre to be doing that 24 hours before such a big key Premier League match. But there you go. It's interesting on Levy. I think the Tottenham's biggest problem has been they probably weren't very realistic with the timescale originally. I think people might have accepted if they'd done, say, as Chelsea proposed to do, and say, well, look, we're not going to be able to play at home for 3 years. I mean, Tottenham could have been 2 years, two seasons. We won't be at White Hart Lane. But bear with us, and when we get there, you'll love it. I suspect in 3 years' time, when we look back, and Tottenham have got one of the best stadiums in Europe, we won't worry so much about this little disconcerting period. But I mean, I know Tottenham season ticket holders have now received their season ticket to the new ground, which they're not going to be able to use until next year at the earliest. And they're sort of drifting up to White Hart Lane to use the marvellous new shop that's open, but there isn't actually a stadium worthy of use yet attached to that. But it's just a matter of patience. I mean, let's look more long-term. Daniel Levy and Tottenham Hotspur will have created an amazing stadium in one of London's most deprived areas. They've stayed local. We were talking about community earlier. They've done that. So let's see where we are in 3 years' time and see how Tottenham are enjoying that.
And, you know, we live in a world where it shows your medals. Do they need to win something? So, for instance, should they prioritise the League Cup? You know, they've got West Ham in midweek. Champions League's not looking great, is it?
And that advert's not looking great, is it? About the only place to see Champions League football in London. I've thought for a while they need to... you know, this whole thing where you need to win something gets misinterpreted. They don't need to win something to prove that Poch is doing a great job, that they've got good players. But they need to win something to help themselves develop. That's a key thing. I think it would be enormously valuable for those players to have, you know, to seal what they've been through with some kind of, you know, silverware to show from it. And at least go to a final and go close, you know. The fact that Wande Ramos is still the last trophy-winning Spurs manager is bizarre when you think how good Spurs have been since then. But there it is. So, yeah, that for them, that's probably the most important competition at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, as we said earlier, Chelsea is a club that is very familiar to you, Dom. Is there a different mood there this year? And if so, is that down to Sarri?
Well, there is a different mood, and that is because of Sarri. But I'm sort of loath to get too carried away because there was a different mood at Chelsea when Antonio Conte was in his first 6 months in charge or a year in charge. And there was a different mood at Chelsea when Jose Mourinho was winning the title there in 2014-15. They are a squad that seem to respond well and need change now and again. And including people like Eden Hazard in that mix as well. It's all looking very, very rosy at the moment and very promising. And he's obviously doing an excellent job. They've bought into the philosophy in terms of his style of play. They're winning games. They're getting, you know, they're getting evidence that the style of play is working every time they go out onto the pitch. You get players who are revived, like Ross Barkley. It's great to see him doing so well of late. But even some of the older guys who had sort of gone into a lull, people like Willian, Pedro even, you could argue Hazard at times. They're just benefiting from a fresh pair of eyes and a fresh way of working down the training ground. I think they'll do really well under Sarri, and there's no reason to think this is suddenly going to be derailed mid-season. This feels like a season when Chelsea will challenge to a certain point where they can, you know, where they can maintain City's levels, remains to be seen, but they're moving in the right direction. I actually think that the test of Chelsea is next season. I mean, when, you know, what's happened with Hazard by then? Does Conte turning up at Real Madrid actually benefit Chelsea?
You'd have thought so, wouldn't you?
You really would. you know, but how do they react second time round to Sarri? I mean, Sarri will keep demanding more. He's not going to take the foot off the gas. I mean, Conte was demanding and demanding and demanding, and eventually the players just said, "Oh, enough! Can't do this anymore." Are they going to feel the same under Sarri next year?
I mentioned earlier how I think we're in an age where the trick for football clubs or managers is to make players feel that they're enjoying themselves, that there's a sense of meaning in this industry. And Sarri's definitely done that. I saw Tony Rudiger last week, and he said, you know, at the end of the time under Conte, he was asking himself, where is the fun? Now, Sarri's brought that back. But as Dom alludes to, you've got to keep that going. So are they still going to be enjoying it next year? I don't know. I mean, Sarri seems like a great guy to me. Seems like the kind of bloke you'd want to play for. But I don't know enough to know whether they're still going to be in this kind of mood next season.
I don't get the impression we're going to get the same level of political intrigue between Sarri and the hierarchy.
No.
Which will benefit them. But then Chelsea are a club that expects to win things. And if, you know, City and Liverpool make a clean sweep of domestic. Yeah. I mean, there is a possibility that there is impatience there as well, possibly further down the line. Yeah.
And talking about impatience, you know, you've got Ruben Loftus-Cheek, hat-trick in Europe, goal-scoring cameo on Sunday. You've got Jadon Sancho, 4 goals in his last 3 games for Dortmund. Compare and contrast.
Yeah, and what, Sancho's 4 years younger than Loftus-Cheek, 3 years younger. He will become the poster boy for a lot of young players, top young players. I think it's already having impact at City, who have got a question over Diaz, brilliant young Spaniard. I think he's wanted.
There's a bit of saber-rattling about Phil Foden's contract as well.
Foden is being looked at by some really big clubs in Europe. But he's a City boy, and I'd expect him to sign this contract. But there's interest there. I think if Loftus-Cheek, he's a great talent, and Sarri's starting to use him. So he could cease to be the cautionary tale. But at the moment, he is a kind of cautionary tale. This kid that what Mourinho said 4 years ago that if he's not in the first team, he doesn't become a top England player, then it's, you know, there's something wrong with the game. And it has looked for 3 or 4 years, despite his talent, that might happen. You have to play as a kid. You just have to play. And Sancho is demonstrating that. And, you know, in another way, Loftus-Cheek has been demonstrating that too.
Mm. But Ruben isn't the kid. I mean, he's 22.
Yeah.
And he's as great as that last week has been, that has to be the norm.
Yeah.
It can't be that in January he's still just having 10 minutes off the bench. Mm-hmm. Because there will be, I mean, I got the impression that, you know, that we were reaching breaking point and that there's a contractual situation there as well. He won't be signing a new long-term deal if he goes out on loan because he wants permanent.
He wants a career.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can I end this, Mike? You know, almost going back to Saturday, which was a truly terrible day, which began with Glenn Hoddle collapsing in the BT Sports studios, being saved, you know, by the prompt action of a sound engineer. Again, there was another outpouring of emotion at an event like that. Let's spend a couple of minutes just appreciating how good Glenn One was as a player and maybe how unfulfilled he was as a coach.
Yeah, I mean, the thing Glenn Hoddle's one of those figures in your life that you know, as a football fan, is large and constant because he caught your imagination as a kid. And I grew up in the northeast of Scotland, miles from London and all that sort of stuff. But even as a Scot, Glenn Hoddle was someone, you know, Stevie Archibald's teammate, and you saw him in 81 Cup final, all that sort of stuff. But he was, there was something a bit special about him. He played the game a little bit differently. He had this talent. We used to go out in the park and try Glenn Hoddle volleys. You know, it was that kind of bloke you were watching. And I think, you know, him being different is what sort of defines Glenn Hoddle. He was a different kind of coach, thought differently, different tactically. He was maybe ahead of his time, but he tried to bring a different style of football to the English national team. A bit different as a pundit as well. Again, a deep thinker, underrated as a pundit, very good columns in the Mail on Sunday where you get the benefit of that sort of football mind. And just, yeah, his own man, a bit of a one-off. You know, I remember watching him as a sweeper at Chelsea towards the end. I mean, he was fabulous in that role as well. Mm. We everyone wanted to be Glenn Hoddle when you were a kid, even a Scot.
Yeah, my favourite memory was watching him score what's become a bit of a fabled goal at Watford, in that old rickety wooden press box where you had a perfect view of him chipping Steve Sherwood, who was then the Watford goalkeeper, just going backwards and backwards and thinking, I'm not going to get it. It's little memories like that, little vignettes, which actually make a player, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad. I mean, that's one of the joys of social media. That if you trace through Twitter now, search for Glenn Hoddle, all these goals are suddenly appearing. The Oxford United goal where he waltzes through the entire defence and then just dummies the goalkeeper and slots it into an empty net. Gorgeous. I was talking to David Pleat about Glenn yesterday, and it was about the way to pass and the spin that he put on the ball, the through passes that were perfect. They were just cushion off the turf, ideal for the striker to run onto. Just a very, very, very special talent and an unusual talent for England to really produce. Which is presumably why we cherish him so much. Interesting on the coaching side. I do want. I know he's a brilliant pundit, a good pundit, but I wonder whether communication was actually an issue for him as a manager and a coach. For all that he had amazing ideas and was such a great player, it must have been difficult for them to translate those ideas and transpose them onto players who didn't have the same amount of ability that he did as a player. But one of the greats, and it's wonderful that the news is encouraging on his recovery.
Get well soon, Glenn. Football's a rough and tumble world, but you're loved. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.